it had been observed. Perhaps. But I will venture a more cautious idea. The fact that every organism evokes its own environment must be corrected with the polar or opposite fact that the total environment evokes the organism. Furthermore, the total environment, or situation, is both spatial and temporal, both larger and longer than the organisms contained in its field. The organism evokes knowledge of a past before it began, and of a future beyond its death. At the other pole, the universe would not have started or manifested itself unless it was at some time going to include organisms, just as current will not begin to flow from the positive end of a wire until the negative terminal is secure. The principle is the same, whether it takes the universe billions of years to polarize itself in the organism, or whether it takes the current, 1 second, to traverse a wire 186,000 miles long. I repeat that the difficulty of understanding the organism-slash-environment polarity is psychological. The history and the geographical distribution of the myth are uncertain, but for several thousand years, we have been obsessed with a false humility. On the one hand, putting ourselves down as mere creatures, who came into this world by the whim of God or the fluke of blind forces, and on the other, conceiving ourselves as separate personal egos fighting to control the physical world. We have lacked the real humility of recognizing that we are members of the biosphere, the harmony of contained conflicts in which we cannot exist at all without the cooperation of plants, insects, fish, cattle, and bacteria. In the same measure, we have lacked the proper self-respect of recognizing that I, the individual organism, am a structure of such fabulous ingenuity that it calls the whole universe into being. In the act of putting everything at a distance so as to describe and control it, we have orphaned ourselves both from the surrounding world and from our own bodies, leaving I as a discontented and alienated spook, anxious, guilty, unrelated, and alone. We have attained a view of the world and a type of sanity which is dried out, like a rusty beer can on the beach. It is a world of objects, of nothing buts, as ordinary as a formica table with chromium fittings. We find it immensely reassuring, except that it won't stay put, and must therefore be defended even at the cost of scouring the whole planet back to a nice, clean rock. For life is, after all, a rather messy and gooey accident in our basically geological universe. If a man's son asks for bread, will he give him a stone? The answer is probably yes. Yet this is no quarrel with scientific thinking, which, as of this date, has gone far, far beyond Newtonian billiards and the myth of the fully automatic, mechanical universe of mere objects. That was where science really got its start, but in accordance with William Blake's principle that the fool who persists in his folly will become wise, the persistent scientist is the first to realize the obsolescence of old models of the world. Open a good standard textbook on quantum theory. The world cannot be analyzed correctly into distinct parts. Instead, it must be regarded as an indivisible unit in which separate parts appear as valid approximations only in the classical, that is, Newtonian limit. Thus, at the quantum level of accuracy, an object does not have any intrinsic properties, for instance, wave or particle, belonging to itself alone. Instead, it shares all its properties mutually and indivisibly with the systems with which it interacts. Moreover, because a given object, such as an electron, interacts at different times with different systems that bring out different potentialities, it undergoes continual transformation between the various forms, for instance, wave or particle form, in which it can manifest itself. Although such fluidity and dependence of form on the environment have not been found before the advent of quantum theory at the level of elementary particles in physics, they are not uncommon in fields such as biology, which deal with complex systems. Thus, under suitable environmental conditions, a bacterium can develop into a spore stage, which is completely different in structure and vice versa. David Bohm, Quantum Theory. Then there is the other complementary side of the picture, as presented by the eminent biophysicist Erwin Schrödinger. It is not possible that this unity of knowledge, feeling, and choice, which you call your own, should have sprung into being from nothingness at a given moment not so long ago. Rather, this knowledge, feeling, and choice are essentially eternal and unchangeable and numerically one in all men, nay, in all sensitive beings. But not in this sense, that you are a part, a piece, of an eternal infinite being, an aspect of modification of it, as in Spinoza's pantheism. For we should have the same baffling question, which part, which aspect are you? What objectively differentiates it from the others? No, but inconceivable as it seems to ordinary reason, you and all other conscious beings as such are all in all. Hence, this life of yours which you are living is not merely a piece of the entire existence, but is, in a certain sense, the whole. Only this whole is not so constituted that it can be surveyed in one single glance. Erwin Schrödinger, My View of the World. The universe implies the organism, and each single organism implies the universe. Only the single glance of our spotlight, narrowed attention, which has been taught to confuse its glimpses with separate things, must somehow be opened to the full vision, which Schrödinger goes on to suggest. Thus you can throw yourself flat on the ground, stretched out upon Mother Earth, with a certain conviction that you are one with her and she with you. You are as firmly established, as invulnerable as she, indeed a thousand times firmer and more invulnerable. As surely as she will engulf you tomorrow, so surely will she bring you forth anew to new striving and suffering. And not merely some day. Now, today, every day, she is bringing you forth, not once, but thousands upon thousands of times, just as every day she engulfs you a thousand times over. For eternally and always, there is only now, one and the same now. The present is the only thing that has no end. 5. So what? To have spoken of a new vision is to be asked, in the next breath, what good it will do. When you come to think of it, this is astonishing, but it is invariably true in speaking with people brought up in the environment of Protestantism. Catholics, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, and Taoists understand that vision or contemplation is good in itself, even the supreme good, in the sense of the beatific vision, where all beings are eternally absorbed in the knowledge and love of God. But this possibility makes Protestants nervous, and one of their official prayers asks that those in heaven may be granted continual growth in thy love and service, because, after all, you can't stop progress. Even heaven must be a growing community. The reason is, I suppose, that modern Protestantism, in particular, in its liberal and progressive forms, is the religion most strongly influenced by the mythology of the world of objects and of man as the separate ego. Man, so defined and so experienced, is, of course, incapable of pleasure and contentment, let alone creative power. Hoaxed into the illusion of being an independent, responsible source of actions, he cannot understand why what he does never comes up to what he should do, for a society which has defined him as separate cannot persuade him to behave as if he really belonged. Thus he feels chronic guilt and makes the most heroic efforts to placate his conscience. From these efforts come social services, hospitals, peace movements, foreign aid programs, free education, and the whole philosophy of the welfare state. Yet we are bedeviled by the fact that the more these heroic and admirable enterprises succeed, the more they provoke new and increasingly horrendous problems. For one thing, few of us have ever thought through the problem of what good such enterprises are ultimately supposed to achieve. When we have fed the hungry, clothed the naked and housed the homeless, what then? Is the object to enable unfortunate people to help those still more unfortunate? To convert Hindus and Africans into a huge bourgeoisie, where every Bengali and every Zulu has the privilege of joining our special rat race, buying appliances on time, and a television set to keep him running? Some years ago, a friend of mine was walking through tea plantations near Darjeeling and noticed one particular group of fields where the bushes were all shriveled. On asking why, it was explained that the owner had felt so sorry for his impoverished workers that he had paid them double. But as a result, they had turned up for work only half the time, which was disastrous in the critical season when the plants have to be tended every day. My friend put this problem to an Indian communist. His solution was to pay them double and compel them to work. He then put it to an American businessman. His solution was to pay them double and put radios in their homes. No one seemed to understand that those workers valued time for goofing off more than money. It is hard for compulsive activists to see that the vast social and economic problems of the world cannot be settled by mere effort and technique. The outsider cannot just barge in like Santa Claus and put things to right, especially our kind of outsider who, because he has no sense of belonging in the world, invariably smells like an interferer. He does not really know what he wants, and therefore everyone suspects that there are limitless strings attached to his gifts. For if you know what you want, and will be content with it, you can be trusted. But if you do not know, your desires are limitless and no one can tell how to deal with you. Nothing satisfies an individual incapable of enjoyment. I'm not saying that American and European corporations are run by greedy villains who live off the fat of the land at everyone else's expense. The point becomes clear only as one realizes, with compassion and sorrow, that many of our most powerful and wealthy men are miserable dupes and captives in a treadmill who, with the rarest exceptions, have not the ghost of a notion how to spend and enjoy money. If I had been a heathen, I'd have praised the purple vine. My slaves would dig the vineyards, and I would drink the wine. But Higgins is a heathen, and his slaves grow lean and grey, that he may drink some tepid milk exactly twice a day. G.K. Chesterton, The Song of the Strange Ascetic, Collected Poems. The startling truth is that our best efforts for civil rights, international peace, population control, conservation of natural resources, and assistance to the starving of the earth, urgent as they are, will destroy rather than help if made in the present spirit. For as things stand, we have nothing to give. If our own riches and our own way of life are not enjoyed here, they will not be enjoyed anywhere else. Certainly they will supply the immediate jolt of energy and hope that methadrine and similar drugs give in extreme fatigue, but peace can be made only by those who are peaceful, and love can be shown only by those who love. No work of love will flourish out of guilt, fear, or hollowness of heart, just as no valid plans for the future can be made by those who have no capacity for living now. The separate person is without content, in both senses of the word. He lives perpetually on hope, on looking forward to tomorrow, having been brought up this way from childhood when his uncomprehending rage at double binds was propitiated with toys. If you want to find a true folk religion in our culture, look at the rites of Santa Claus. Even before the beginning of Advent, which was supposed to be a 3 to 4 week fasting period in preparation for the feast, the streets are decorated for Christmas. The shops glitter with tinsel and festive displays of gifts, and public address systems warble electronic carols so that one is sick to death of Venite Adoremus long before Christmas Day. Trees are already baubled and illumined in most homes, and as the big build-up proceeds, they are surrounded by those shiny packages with shimmering ribbons which look as if they held gifts for princes. By this time, Christmas parties have already been held in schools and offices before closing for the actual holiday, so that by Christmas Eve, the celebrations have just about blown their top. But there are still those packages under the tree and stockings by the fireplace. When, at last, the day comes, the children are frantic. Hardly able to wait for breakfast and not having slept most of the night, they tear those gold and silver parcels to shreds as if they contained nothing less than the elixir of life or the philosopher's stone. By noon, the living room looks as if a waste paper truck had crashed into a dime store, leaving a wreck of mangled cartons, excelsior, wrapping paper, and writhing ribbons, neckties, upended dolls, half-assembled model railroads, spacesuits, plastic atom bombs, and scattered chocolate bars. Hundreds of tinker toy pieces, crushed tree ornaments, miniature sports cars, water pistols, bottles of whiskey, and balloons. An hour later, the children are blubbering or screaming and have to be shooed out of doors while the mess is shoved together to make room for Christmas dinner. Thereafter, the 12 days of Christmas are spent with upset stomachs, colds and influenza, and on New Year's Eve the adults get stoned to forget the whole thing. Well, it was fun describing it, but the point is that intense expectation fizzled. The girl was gorgeous, but the guy was impotent. But since there must be something somewhere, expectation is kindled again to keep us all going for that golden, voluptuous goodie at the end of the line. What could it be? The children knew it well until they got caught in the rat race. One of the best Christmas presents I ever had was a cheap ring with a glass diamond. It was quite incidental, something that came out of a snapper or cracker at a party. But I sat down in front of the fireplace with this enchanted object and turned it to catch the different colours of light which blazed inside it. I knew that I had found the Ring of Solomon, with which he summoned jinns and afrits with wings of brass, and it wasn't that I wanted them to do anything for me, for it was just enough to be in that atmosphere, to watch these magical beings come to life in the flames of the fire, and to feel that I was in touch with the timeless paradise world. Now it is symptomatic of our rusty beer can type of sanity that our culture produces very few magical objects. Jewelry is slick and uninteresting. Architecture is almost totally bereft of exuberance, obsessed with erecting glass boxes. Children's books are written by serious ladies with three names and no imagination. And as for comics, have you ever looked at the furniture in Dagwood's home? The potentially magical ceremonies of the Catholic Church are either gabbled away at top speed or rationalized with the aid of a commentator. Drama or ritual in everyday behavior is considered affectation and bad form, and manners have become indistinguishable from mannerisms, where they exist at all. We produce nothing comparable to the great Oriental carpets, Persian glass, tiles and illuminated books, Arabian leatherwork, Spanish marquetry, Hindu textiles, Chinese porcelain and embroidery, Japanese lacquer and brocade, French tapestries or Inca jewelry. Though, incidentally, there are certain rather small electronic devices that come unwittingly close to fine jewels. The reason is not just that we are too much in a hurry and have no sense of the present. Not just that we cannot afford the type of labor that such things would now involve, nor just that we prefer money to materials. The reason is that we have scrubbed the world clean of magic. We have lost even the vision of paradise, so that our artists and craftsmen can no longer discern its forms. This is the price that must be paid for attempting to control the world from the standpoint of an eye, for whom everything that can be experienced is a foreign object and a nothing but. It would be sentimental and impossible to go back. Children are in touch with paradise to the extent that they have not fully learned the ego trick, and the same is true of cultures which, by our standards, are more primitive and, by analogy, childlike. If then, after understanding, at least in theory, that the ego trick is a hoax and that beneath everything I and universe are one, you ask, so what? What is the next step? The practical application? I will answer that the absolutely vital thing is to consolidate your understanding, to become capable of enjoyment, of living in the present, and of the discipline which this involves. Without this, you have nothing to give to the cause of peace or of racial integration, to starving Hindus and Chinese, or even to your closest friends. Without this, all social concern will be muddlesome meddling, and all work for the future will be planned disaster. But the way is not back. Just as science overcame its purely atomistic and mechanical view of the world through more science, the ego trick must be overcome through intensified self-consciousness. For there is no way of getting rid of the feeling of separateness by a so-called act of will, by trying to forget yourself, or by getting absorbed in some other interest. This is why moralistic preaching is such a failure. It breeds only cunning hypocrites. People sermonized into shame, guilt, or fear, who thereupon force themselves to behave as if they actually loved others, so that their virtues are often more destructive and arouse more resentment than their vices. A British social service project, run by earnest and rather formidable ladies called the Charity Organization Society, COS for short,